So, for this morning's Dhamma talk, I continue on how we meditate. And because yesterday some very kind people gave me a little lotus with lots of cheese and chocolate inside of it, but it reminded me of one of those wonderful similes for meditation, the thousand-petal lotus simile. And because it's the chant which is perhaps one of the most famous Buddhist chants, the Om Mani Padme Hum, and of course I think most of you would have known by now what that means, is the first word and the last word, the Om and the Hum. It's just, it's like the Namo in Namo Tassa. It's just a word of like reverence, respect, homage. And so the main words are the two in between, the Mani Padme, which means the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Now what does that refer to, the jewel in the heart of the lotus? So, a lotus flower closes up at night time, and when the first rays of the sun hit the lotus in the early morning, the light and the warmth hit the outermost sheath of the lotus flower, and it starts to open out to reveal the next layer of petals of the lotus. So they now can receive the light and the warmth of the sun. So they now can open up to reveal the second layer of petals. So they can receive the light and the warmth of the sun. And that means that layer by layer, the lotus opens up. And the deeper you go into that lotus, the more beautiful are the petals. The more fragrant is the scent, and the more refined are the petals as you go closer and closer to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And what does that simile mean to meditation? You are that lotus. And when you first come to do some meditation, you're like the lotus at night time, all closed up. And on the outermost sheath, I wouldn't even call it petals of that lotus, it's all like corrugated, it's hard, it's dirty, it's dusty, it's rough. And anybody who saw that closed up lotus would never believe in their wildest imaginations that inside is these beautiful, delightful petals, and even something more amazing right in the middle. They think it's just a dirty old plant. But it can open up. And the way it opens up is just the outermost sheath has to be dirty and rough, because that has to withstand the storms, the pollution, the wind, the insects, and everything else. It protects what's inside. But the sun rises, and the light and the warmth hit that rough outermost petal, and of course it does open up. And you see something a bit more delightful. And layer by layer it opens up. So you are the outermost petal. And some I've seen some really rough outermost petals. I've seen some outermost petals in my life as a teacher who I thought nothing could really interesting can be inside. And one of those rough outermost petals which really, really shocked me was this guy who came to one of my retreats, an Australian guy. And he was big, he was rough, he was covered with tattoos all over, just about. And as soon as he came in, I stereotyped him. You should never do that, but you know, we do it, you know, sometimes almost unconsciously, subconsciously rather, and not unconsciously. subconsciously. And when I saw him, really rough, and straight away I thought, you know, you've got the wrong place, mate. I said, the prison is up the road. Which is it, 6 kilometres up the road is a prison. I said, you want to meet your friends who are up there? He said, no, I've booked in for this retreat. And so I looked in the list, and he was actually booked in. He was actually coming to the retreat. I thought, well, you know, just got to be open-minded. Just anyone can come, who knows? But, you know, that straight away I thought, nah, not him. And of course, during the retreat, he was following the instructions, he was meditating, he was relaxing. And he was one of these fellows, when he came into my for an interview, he started saying what was happening to him in his meditation. And my goodness, it was a jhana. That fellow had actually just, you know, the star meditator in the whole retreat, and he had, you know, really got a real full-on jhana experience. And that blew me away. And I thought, my goodness, I can't see who's going to get these things and who's not going to get these things. And by the way, you know, that, you know, people talk about jhanas, and sometimes that people say, oh yeah, that could have been a jhana, or that might have been a jhana. But of all the teachers who teach these jhanas, I am the toughest examiner. I say that because somebody sent me a book, and somebody was reviewing all of the modern teachers of meditation and their qualification, their what they ask of a student before they confirm they've got a jhana. And I think they listed 5 very well-known teachers of meditation, and they listed them in order. He said, the easiest one to get confirmation that you had a jhana, when she was alive, was Ayakama. Her level was like, you go to universities. What are the standards to get a sort of a PhD? Some universities, you can just write off and get it by return of post. Some of the standard is very high. Some of the examination, what you have to reach to get that PhD is really, really tough. So of the 5, I think number 5 was Ayakama. I forget who number 4 and number 3 was, but number 2 was Partok Sayadaw. He was really tough to be, you know, to be confirmed that, yeah, that was a jhana. But number 1, the toughest, was Ajahn Brahm. Well, you know, if I said you had a jhana, all the other ones, oh yeah, easy. So I keep the highest standards. So when I said that guy had a jhana, he did have a jhana. Ooh, that's amazing. So any of you haven't got a jhana yet, you've been trying for years, obviously the answer is get some tattoos. But it's nothing about tattoos, obviously. But everyone has got the jhana inside them. Just like the lotus, you've got the most beautiful, delightful petals inside. So it's never the case that there's something wrong with you, that you were born different than everybody else. That's one of the reasons the Satipatthana Sutta keeps on saying all these things in me, in others, in both, it's the same. So you have them inside of you, but the point is how to access them, how to open up your lotus layer by layer to get inside. That's why I love that lotus simile. You are those lotuses. So how do you open a lotus? You just got to let the light and the warmth of the sun open it up. What does that mean? The light of the sun is called mindfulness. And the warmth of the sun is kindness. You need both together, the warmth and the light, the mindfulness and kindness to open up your lotus and see what's inside. So how that works, you sit here with a full belly, not too full, not too empty. You've had your breakfast, so you feel comfortable. You're kind to your body. You sit down in a comfortable position, in the chairs, on the stools, so that you can relax the body. And don't worry about sitting on the chair. Sometimes you can sit on the chairs all the time. Sometimes you can sit on the floor. Wherever you can find comfort. And if you're always worried about falling asleep and falling off the chair, if you're afraid of heights, we can always get you a motorcycle crash helmet and a seatbelt. Stop you falling off. Because sometimes people do start nodding. But anyway, it's just part of life. Sometimes people don't sleep well or whatever. But I remember in Thailand. Okay, I don't mind telling these little silly stories. When we used to have these big celebrations, like today is the Mahapawarana day, a full moon day. And so many temples they would have in Thailand, forest temples in the northeast. They'd have big functions from now until the end of the Katina season, where many monks would be invited, and there'd be like talks all night, Dhamma teachings, until late into the night, and sometimes all night until early morning. So, some of those teachings were very boring. And so, one of the things which, you know, was the entertainment, that we were all sitting on these benches, a little bit higher than this, and there'd always be some young little novices, you know, who would be there. And every now and again, the novice would start, you know, getting nodding. And from experience, we knew that the nodding would get more extreme. And so as soon as, you know, one came, well, I think this is where they got the word tipping point from. As soon as close to the tipping point, you know, the monk next to me would sort of say, hey, something's coming up here. And he'd go, more and more, it's very cool, we should have stopped the little novice. And even the lay people were looking at the novice because they know what's going to happen next. Because the sermon was boring. And then nodded more and more, and then he'd fall off. And then these are like robes, there's nothing much to them, and they just all fall off. And this poor little novice was very, very embarrassed. And that was the humiliating entertainment for the evening. So much for compassionate monks. It was very funny. But anyway, so you're kind to your body. When you're kind to your body, again, we do the next thing, the mindfulness and kindness, as I mentioned to you, the body awareness, but not just awareness, with kindness too. So you look at your body. Does it need to be adjusted? And even during meditation, if you've got like an ache, say in your knee or your foot or somewhere, if you have an ache somewhere, you know, you can, after a while, you know it's just going to go away by itself. Or if you want to move, please move. Just adjust the body. It takes maybe 5 or 10 seconds. Yes, it does disturb the meditation. Well, after 5 or 10 seconds, the pressure's off, the body is nice and comfortable, and you soon get back to where you were before you started moving, but now with no pain, no discomfort, so you can go much, much deeper into meditation. So don't just bear with aches and pains, because it gets worse and worse and worse. It's the same with coughing. I've often noticed this, that sometimes when people have a little bit of an itch in their throat, and they think, oh, I'm not going to cough because that's going to disturb everybody. So then we get what I call in meditation the volcano effect. Exactly, thank you. You suppress the cough. You block it off. You plug it up. you know, you're really itching, no, I'm not going to cough, I'm going to disturb everybody. And because you restrain it over much, you plug it up, you resist it, the pressure builds. The irritation gets stronger and stronger. It's going to blow. And when it does blow, it's a huge noise. And even people in the kitchen get disturbed. And worse than that, just like a volcano, you can actually hear it miles off. The volcano spews all this unhealthy gas and other stuff around the people sitting next to you. So that's one of the reasons why. If you're going to cough, just cough. Which means that, you know, it just sometimes just one little cough is all that's needed and it releases the pressure and you can get into deeper meditation. Why not? So this is actually a bit of sense with the body, a bit of kindness with the body. So that you can learn how to work with the body and relax it. So eventually the body actually just disappears. Of course, the other thing is a very obvious thing, but it's sometimes a very disturbance for people when they're meditating, the saliva in their throat. Should I have to keep on swallowing it? Because if I keep on swallowing it, it goes on and on and on and on and on. But if I, okay, I'm not going to swallow, and it starts dribbling down here. That's really embarrassing. But it's just, that only happens when you start worrying about it. The rest of the time, you want to swallow, just swallow. It just does it automatically, just like when you're working on a computer or something, you don't really get disturbed by the saliva in your throat. It just happens. But if you have a really big problem with that, if it's something the matter with you, with your too much saliva, it's usually because you're thinking too much about food. But if there's too much of a problem with saliva, my solution is, I haven't done it yet because it hasn't been necessary, but I'm sure we can actually get a collection together to get one of these. And that's one of those little things you see at the dentist. So while you're meditating, and that will be the no more problems with your saliva. Of course, there'll be other problems with making too much noise. But nevertheless, it's a small, you're kind to it. You're aware, you're kind, and usually the problem vanishes and disappears. So the whole of the body, you're kind to it. And what I was saying yesterday with the samadhi headache, you're kind, you can feel this tension there, so that's not going to be helpful for your meditation. So you're aware of the body and you're just kind to it, you relax it. And that's what kindness does. I think you all know, if you go into a room and there's some really, really bad people in there, you get very tense. I remember the monk, Dhamma Wuto, he's the Sister Gotami's brother. He's a monk over in Taiping. Taiping? No, not Taiping. Wait, in Malaysia, sorry? Timor, that's right, Timor. But he's told me once that when he was a young monk, he was at a dana, people were feeding him, and into the room came this fellow who was the executioner for the Malaysian government. The guy who would actually pull the lever so that when people got hung. He's only doing his job. You know, he wasn't a mean man, but as soon as he came in the room, I remember Venerable Dhamma Wuto said, "Oh, he could really feel bad vibes, you know, from the national executioner." And sort of, you know, when somebody, a bad thing comes, or a bad person, or someone with a lot of trouble, you can feel them when they come into the room. But if it's really a nice, kind person, a really gentle person, it relaxes you. So if you want your body to relax, and it comes and sees the national executioner, which is yourself, do this, do that, don't do that, bad. Be kind to your body and mind. Then it relaxes. And when it relaxes, you actually feel peaceful. And the body can get so peaceful, it can disappear. At least the coarser part of the body. So you can start watching your mind. A layer of petals has opened up. So you're going inside. Not your body anymore, but your mind. So when you see your mind, you have the peaceometer. How peaceful are you today? How agitated are you today? You find out why. So one of these next layer of petals is what I call the layer of petals called like time. Are you really gone into the middle of time? Or are you still concerned about the past? About all the bad things which you've done? All the terrible stuff from the past? And I mentioned, please be kind to the past. So if you have any bad memories, please delete them. Delete, 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 delete. Any good memories, save them. At least you're keeping good stuff. I always remember my good memories. Sometimes I remember my bad memories, like doing the chanting for the Get Better chanting when the family wanted the Die Peaceful chanting. So please, when you ask me to do some chanting for you or a blessing before you go, please ask what chanting it is. Otherwise I might do the Die Peacefully chanting and it's your fault because you never told me that's not what you wanted. This other time, there's a Sri Lankan disciple. And the Sri Lankan people have got very long names. And so it's very hard to remember them. And so it was just... One of the Sri Lankan disciples, whose parent had died, asked me to do the funeral ceremony for them. So I went there to the funeral parlour and I had to welcome everybody with the MC and say, we come here today on this sad occasion of, you know, my disciple, I think, say, Jai Nutty or something, that his mother has passed away. And then this old lady at the front immediately stood up. She said, it's not me who's passed away, it's my husband. I'm still alive. I had a 50-50 chance and I chose the wrong one. I knew it was one of the parents, but didn't actually remember which one. And everybody broke up laughing. And that was the end of the solemnity of that funeral service. Very good fun. But actually, just on funeral, I guess a really, really wonderful funeral. My favourite funeral... It's my favourite funerals now. My favourite funeral was of Steve, the whitewater rafter, and his wife Jenny. Jenny still comes up to Dhammaloka every now and again. And only a young man. And anyway, when he died, because he was a whitewater rafter, Ajahn Brahm, know it all, I told them, I said, well, look, you don't have to buy a coffin. You can make your own. And, you know, it's you make it like, custom made, so it's like personal. And as long as you have the right sort of dimensions, the size, then that's fine. So they made it, because of the white water rafter, like a little boat with oars on the top. And it was okay, the right size, only they made it of really thick Jarrah hardwood. It weighed a ton. And, you know, taking it from the hearse to put it on this little conveyor belt, it was like an open committal. That took so many young men, it almost killed a few of those as well. Almost had some more business for the funeral director. But it was so heavy that when they, you know, pressed the button to actually, it went behind, you know, it was a little screen. The screen went away, goes behind, then the screen closes afterwards. But it was so heavy, the poor motor could hardly move it. So it went halfway through, but then the screen closed. And it was stuck halfway. Halfway in and halfway out. And I could always remember the look on the funeral director's face. You know, he really went white, because when something goes wrong, it's his fault. And then the wife, Jenny, she jumped up on the conveyor belt and started to push. And of course, that's when all his friends said, "Are you really trying to get rid of him that much?" And there was jokes flying all over the place. He said, "Oh yeah, I remember Steve, the first day when he was young. Well, first day he got his car, he crashed it on the first day. First day in his coffin, he crashes that too. Typical Steve." And, you know, sometimes when things go wrong, that's actually human. And that's funny. And that makes the whole thing memorable. That's one of the best funeral services I ever did. Because I always remember that. Just how it became very, very... It's another one I did. I remember Guildford ceremony. I don't know why these funeral directors... You know, they had the cortege, and we were walking, and we were walking, and we were walking. I said, "Do you know actually where we're going?" And he said, "No, not really." He'd lost the plot. Oh, come on, that's a terrible joke. Anyway, what was that? Oh, meditation, yes. So there he was. That when you have some happiness, it's much easier to relax the body. Isn't this actually sometimes the reason why I tell jokes, making people laugh? It does relax you. It takes away a lot of fear and a lot of tension and tightness. And so when you are, your body's relaxed, you can go into the mind, you can let go of the past. That's what I was talking about. Yeah, you make mistakes, we all make mistakes, and we can laugh at them. You know, sometimes they can hurt, but you know, that's life. We learn from our mistakes. And so the future again, we can let that go too. And for those of you who want a nice exercise, because I'll be doing exercises in the morning meditations, we can try this one now. This is the two shopping bags exercise. So if you'd like to close your eyes now. And with your eyes closed, just, you know, relax the body. Now imagine you've been shopping and you've been carrying two bags, one in the left hand, one in the right hand, shopping bags. And they're really full and they're very heavy. And you've been carrying them for a long time. So long that you're arms ache and your shoulders hurt. You've all done that before, so you know what I'm talking about. You can even visualize your arms aching and your shoulders hurting because you're tired. And you look at the shopping bag in your left hand, which is so heavy, and you look upon the label on the outside. It's not Gucci or Versace, or I don't know any other labels, but you look on the label, it's not that label. The label which you see on the outside of the bag is PAST, past. Because in that shopping bag, you have so many memories of your past. Some good memories, many bad memories. And there's so many in there, it's so heavy. And you've been carrying it around for way too long. Which means that your mind is tired and your heart aches with the weight and the burden of all this stuff you've been carrying in the bag in the left hand called your past. And then you gaze in your imagination at the bag in your right hand, which has got the letters FUTURE on the outside. Future, because in that bag it's stuffed to almost breaking of all of your worries and concerns, anxieties and fears about the future. You've been carrying that for too long as well. So long that again your mind is so exhausted and your heart is burdened. It's not free and energized because of all the stuff you have in the future. So there you are, carrying the two heavy bags, past and future. You can feel their weight, their burden. And now you focus just on the bag in your left hand, the past. So heavy, but it's important stuff. You can't just throw it away. But what you can do is imagine yourself leaning to the left from the waist, and then you lower the bag containing your past. You lower it closer and closer to the ground. And when it's close enough, you can let it go onto the floor. When it reaches the floor, all the weight disappears. The burden is taken by the earth. And that allows you to uncurl your fingers from the handle, to move your hand and your arm up, to straighten your back, so your left arm is free from the past. It can relax, recuperate, energize. You put down the bag representing your past. And now you turn your attention to the bag in your right hand, the future, with all your anxieties, plans, and dreams and hopes as well. And that bag is just so heavy as well. So you lean your body to the right, allowing you to lower the bag in the right hand, the future, closer and closer to the floor. And when it meets the ground, the weight, the heaviness, the burden, the anxiety vanishes. It's taken up by the ground. And you can now uncurl your fingers, raise your hand up to your side, straighten your back, so your right arm and hand are hanging loosely by the side, so they too can recover and energize. In this mental exercise of visualization, you've let go of the past and the future, just in your imagination, and it helps you let go of the real past, the real future. But before you finish this exercise, you gaze down at those two bags. They're no longer heavy, because you're no longer holding them. But they are safe. Unfortunately, no one is going to take them away. They'll be there for you later on. But for now, you put them down. And you are standing between them in this amazing place between the past and the future, which we call the present. A place where you can relax and rest, to re-energize, so that later on, in your own time, you can pick up those bags again, and because you're rested, they're no longer heavy, no longer much of a burden. The two shopping bags helping you take a break, take a rest, find some freedom, even if only temporary, from your past and your future. So you stand in the present. Okay, you may open your eyes now. So what that is doing is just going inside that layer of petals called past and future time. It's one of the first mental ones. And now when you go inside, you're in the present moment, that's a really delightful petal. And you're doing that because it's mindfulness and kindness, you're aware of time and you're kind enough to give yourself a break from the burden of the past and the anxiety for the future. So now you're in the present moment. And that is a very lovely petal to be able to stay with. It's fragrant, it's beautiful, but of course it's more than just that. So you stay in the present moment, just aware, just kind. You don't do anything. You're just opening the door of your heart to this moment. Sometimes this moment is maybe not what you want. But it's still, it's in this moment, and it's good enough. And it brings me to the story of the prison. Because this monk, I was used to go and teach in prison, a monk took over the job for me in one of these top security jails. And he's a very nice monk, very kind monk. So after a while they got to like this monk. So they found out that monks can't eat any dinner in the evening, but they can have some cheese and chocolate. So they're ready to get some cheese and chocolate, a nice cup of tea for this monk, and invite him to stay a bit longer. And as he was staying a bit longer, they wanted to chat to him, and they started chatting to him about one of the obvious things. What's it like as a monk in a monastery? What do you guys do? And that's when he started telling him about the daily life of a monk in Bodhidharma Monastery, starting off with getting up at 4 o'clock. But he was quite correct in saying getting up at 4 o'clock is optional in Bodhidharma Monastery. It's optional. You can always get up earlier if you want to, but not later. And the prisoners were quite surprised you're supposed to get up that early. They said, even murderers don't have to get up till 6. What bad karma did you do to have to get up so early? But they said, okay, can you watch the TV? Watch the football? Said, no, we don't have TVs in monastery. Maybe later on you can see my cave. There's not a TV in there. So no, we don't have TVs. So what do? We meditate. Okay. And then we have our breakfast. And whenever I come on retreat, I mean, this is a real treat. That's why they call it retreat. I have a proper breakfast here. But if you come and see me over in Bodhidharma Monastery, you have a cup like this. You have 3 Weetabix and some milk and a banana and a cup of tea. And that's it. And I said, wow, you know, in prisons in Australia, you can get whatever you want. You know, you can get noodles, you can get porridge, Western porridge, you can get some Singapore porridge, you get bacon, you get eggs, you get fried this, you get some toast, you get waffles, you can get croissants, you can get whatever you want there. It's a whole banquet. I said, is that all you get? I said, then what do? I mean, we work, maintain the monastery. And even I have to work. I have to work really hard. Yeah, I used to really like working. You know, even here in Jhana Grove, used to get on the roof. I think a couple of years ago, I got on the roof to fix up some plumbing. And the caretakers at the time, I never forgive them for that. Well, I will forgive them, but it was a rotten thing they did. They took a photograph of me and put it on the social media. Ajahn Bhatt, and I got all this, Ajahn Bhatt, do not go on a roof. In your weight, I don't think the rafters can take it. You might fall off, you're too valuable, don't do that. So I couldn't go on a roof anymore. But I used to love working, it's great exercise. And I always remember the time when we were mixing some concrete. And I like getting involved as well. You know, it's actually like, I'm not sure if it's the same these days, and maybe it was just my generation. It's like boys play, a big concrete truck, and mixing it and shoving cement all over the place, and just, it's really good fun, laying concrete. So anyway, I've just been laying concrete with the rest of the monks, and of course you get really dirty. You know, you get sort of splodges of cement here and splodges somewhere else, all over your face as well. So I was from the building site going back to my room to get a shower, and I was on the way, that's when I met this very high-class Sri Lankan woman. And she's wearing expensive sari, lots of makeup, and all her jewellery. And it's a no exaggeration. She has so many little bangles on her that I really did think the ice cream truck had come. So many bangles, dingle, dingle. But anyway, no, she came up to me and said, "I'm looking for Ajahn Brahm. Where's Ajahn Brahm?" And I'm a pretty smart sort of monk. So I realised the right answer was not to say, "I'm Ajahn Brahm." I said, "He'll probably be down in the hall down there in about 15 minutes, if you want to wait for him." "Okay, thank you very much." Which gave me the chance to take a quick shower and change into some clean robes and then go and meet her. And, you know, had a nice discussion about meditation and Dhamma. And at the end, before she left, she said, "Oh, you're a wonderful monastery, you're a really good monk. But," said, "on the way here, I managed to see one of your monks. He was very badly dressed and very dirty. That's not appropriate in a monastery. You know, you should have a word with that monk. He's just really not a good example of..." I said, "Oh, really? Oh, yeah, I will talk to him later, madam." And all the time, she never realised it was the same monk. It was me. Was that deceit, do you think? It wasn't deceit, because I do talk to myself. So I did talk to myself afterwards. But we do work hard. And the prisoner said, "Oh, you never catch us working that hard. You know, we go on strike in Australia. We wouldn't work that hard." So anyway, so then, what do you do for lunch? You see how we have lunch. Even the other day, Ajahn Brahm's birthday, Ajahn Pamali's birthday cake. You're very lucky, because mine fell in, I think it was in some curry or something. Whatever it was, it wasn't very nice, it didn't fit. Because he put it in there, and it's a bowl, it can go anywhere. Sometimes it goes in the right place, sometimes it goes in the wrong place. So, I don't know, many, many times you've had, strawberry ice cream on lasagna. Have you ever had strawberry ice cream on lasagna? You don't know what you're missing. It could be the late... Yeah. Lasagna, yeah, and strawberry ice cream on top. No, it's not. It's terrible. I'm tasting it. It's awful. It's disgusting. That sometimes happens when you have these things. I've had custard on curry. You know, the English custard on curry. That's pretty disgusting too. You know, it was meant to go on the apple pie in that side of the bowl, but you know, it goes on the other side. Like, well, what can you do? And then the prisoners started saying, "Oh, you know, even in solitary confinement, you have like a tray, you know, with your strawberry ice cream there and lasagna somewhere else." So, but you know, well, that's disgusting how you guys eat. And it was, okay, so what do you do after lunch? You meditate, walk meditation, or talk to the people? And then said, "Well, don't you have any exercise? Can't you play sport?" And I actually did think once of starting a Buddhist soccer team. You know, not just to win, but just so that you could actually play the Catholics and the Anglicans and the Hindus and the Jews and the Muslims, just to get some some contact with people of other religions, get some interfaith, because all these interfaith meetings which I have gone to just talk, you never do anything. Imagine you can play together. But then I thought about that. No, it wouldn't work. Because you can't forget your Buddhist principles. The first one of which will be let go. You want the ball? Let go. compassion. You wouldn't tackle anybody. You know, they got the ball. Kindness. Oh, and if they can't score a goal, you score an own goal for them. It makes them happy. I mean, that's the whole thing about Buddhism, a big bodhisattva, letting go. May you be happy. Well, so I realized if we did start a Buddhist soccer team, then we'd always come bottom. I think it's one of the reasons why that you never see like Thailand or Burma or Singapore ever sort of doing well at the World Cup. They never even get to the World Cup finals. The reason is there isn't too many Buddhists in there. Anyway, so we don't play sport, we just meditate after and we're quirky. What about dinner? Dinner? We don't have dinner. You know that. I said, don't have dinner? That's terrible. So what do you do in the evening? You know, can you play cards? I said, no, we don't play cards. Imagine if we did play cards. If I played cards, if I won anything, people would say, stop using your psychic powers, Ajahn Brahm. You're reading our minds. It's unfair. Don't do that. No, you know, you meditate. So what time do you go to bed? Bed? We don't have beds. We sleep on the floor. I have a bed here in the teacher's cottage, but, you know, in the cave, sleep on the floor. Wow, they said, that's so tough being a monk. So, and they actually felt real compassion for their friend, and they felt sorry for him. Just how hard it was living life in Bodhinyana Monastery compared to being in prison. So actually one of them actually said, not realizing what they were saying, he said, well, it's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? They invited him to jail. They had a point. You know, there's a reason for that. You know, it was actually more comfortable. Food, sort of comforts and stuff, much more comfortable in prison than in Bodhinyana Monastery. But it's a waiting list to get into monasteries like Dharamsala or Bodhinyana. Why is that? And that's just where you get the punchline is. In a monastery, people want to be there. In prison, they don't want to be there. That's the only difference. And that just opened up just a whole insight into why people find it hard to stay in the present moment. Because they don't want to be here. They want to be somewhere else. So for many people, the present moment is a prison. I don't want to be here. I want to go out and do something. I want to just watch a movie. I just want to have a cup of tea. I just don't want to be here. And that makes a prison of this moment. And of course the insight started opening up. How many prisons do we make in life for ourselves? You know, you've got a relationship, you know, your husband, wife, and no, I don't want this. I want to get divorced, separated. Try again. See you next time if I can find the right one.
Yeah. There is none.
They always say the second marriage, second relationship, is a triumph over of hope over experience. But anyway, just we feel that I don't want to be here, and your relationship becomes a prison. You go to work, and you don't want to go to work. Your work is a prison. Now you're sick, you've got a cancer, and you hate it. Your body is now a prison for you. Or you're in meditation. You know, it's worse, watching the breath, but you want more. So the breath is a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be, which is not good enough, is called prison. And the only way to escape the prisons of life is to not move, change, go somewhere else. It's just change attitude. From I don't want to be here, so I want to be here. I want to be in this relationship with this person. I want to be in work. I want to be with this sickness. It's teaching me something, I don't know what. I want to be in this meditation. And as soon as you change attitudes, and I want to be somewhere else, I want to be here, then you find you're not in prison anymore. You're free. Freedom doesn't matter, doesn't concern your situation, your health, the people around you. It only concerns whether you want to be here or not. I was over in Indonesia. It was in Jogjakarta once. When, after a big talk, there was a huge line of people wanting their books signed and a photograph. And please know that I don't allow selfies. No selfies. Only weefies. We don't believe in self. No self. This is Buddhist meditation, so no self. Means no selfies. Only weefies. Us. So anyway, there you were, whole line of people, sign the book, take a weefie, sign the book, take a weefie, sign a book, take a... Now, you think that's not much, but for 2 hours, that's a lot of smiling and a lot of signing. And after 1 hour of that, I remember just contemplating, just, I never became a monk to do this. What am I doing? This is not in the Vinaya. The Buddha never had to do this. I said, this is unfair. And I had this moment of like real suffering. I want to get out of here. But I do remember my own teachings. Thank goodness. And I think, Ajahn Brahm, you don't want to be here, do you? You're in prison. I made myself a prison. Just being there and having to have my photograph taken again and sign another book. And I realized that that's not the way to overcome suffering. That's not the way of a Buddhist monk. So I changed my attitude. I want to be here. I want to sign the books. I want to sort of make the silly smarty face on the first A of Ajahn. I want to sort of smile to the people who have queued up for hours to try and get a photograph of me. I want to do this. And when I did that, I was free. I wanted to be here. And that's the same with meditation. Are you sleepy? And you don't want to be here? You want to be bright, energized? That means you put a prison around yourself again. Are you restless? I don't want to be restless. I shouldn't be restless. You know, there's only a few days left. Come on. No, you made a prison. Be restless. It changes the whole ball game. And then you are free. You're peaceful. You're in this moment. Are you cold? You're hot. When I'm cold, it's really good. I mean, it energizes. When it's hot, it's wonderful. Nice and warm. So all of you, I know you're very happy. Either way, I'm just happy to be here. So this is actually where you understand about happy to be here is the only way of being in the present moment. If you want to be somewhere else, you're missing the opportunity. So you want to be here in the present moment, that beautiful layer of petals. If you just want to be here, you're kind in this moment with the present moment. You find you go inside. The next layer of petals opens up by itself. Every time more beautiful, more delightful, more subtle. Inside the present moment. You don't do anything, you don't go on to the next stage. You go into the next stage. Not onto the next stage, you go inside where you already are. More in the present moment, you find, wow, the breathing. Is there anything left, as I said yesterday? You're just sitting there watching the present moment, happy to be here. And you're aware of your breath. And this is where it really starts to get delightful. You don't do anything. You're just aware and kind to your breath. Oh, your poor breath. It's done all the jobs which you asked of it. When you really needed more oxygen because you've been working hard or running, it makes you more oxygen. When you want to relax, you know, less oxygen. It's a credible thing. It's just so well adjusted to your body and to your lifestyle. And so, I say thank you, breath. They said thank you and showed some gratitude to your breathing for all the services done for you ever since you were born. Thank you, breath. I'm not going to force you to tell you what to do. So, I love you, breath. When you're kind to the breath, it relaxes. Like anyone else you're kind to, you relax. And the breath gets very beautiful. It relaxes. You go from just the awareness of the breath, it opens up to the full awareness of the breath. Very beginning to the very end. Even the spaces between the breaths. And you're watching that breath, just full awareness of the breath. You don't do anything, you're just aware. You always maintain your kindness. You're opening the door of your heart, just being with things, with gentleness. And that opens up, and you start to see the joyful breath, the delightful breath, breathing in and out with piti sukha, with joy and happiness. This is where you get to the very beautiful inner petals of your lotus. And you never would believe that inside this whole body and mind, just this amazing, joyful petals as you go deeper and deeper inside. And you're still really with the breath, but it's just how the mind watches the breath. And then you go deep inside that. And then inside the delightful breath, that opens up. Right now you're really getting into beautiful petals. The jitta, the radiant mind, the prabhasara jitta. This is what you see in meditation, the nimittas. Beautiful, gorgeous, powerful. And I say, don't worry, every one of you is going to see a nimitta sooner or later. If not now, that when you die and you go towards the light. So it's going to come to you sooner or later. The sooner the better, because that means you're prepared. We have many, many rehearsals for all sorts of things in life. So this is when you do nimitta meditation. It's rehearsal on how to die. Dying 101 at Jhana Grove. So when it does happen, you know exactly what to do because you've been prepared, you've rehearsed. But before you do that, it's beautiful light. Now, one of the things which happens, or even now, saying just, wow, nimittas, wonderful. I want. And of course, that's no way to open the lotus. One of the great advantages of this simile, to open the lotus, mindfulness and kindness, that is all. Not wanting, not effort, mindfulness and kindness. That's what opens the lotus. If you disturb that, sometimes the lotus closes up again. So just be aware and be kind. And then the more aware, the more kind, the longer you are aware, the longer you are kind, uninterrupted, your lotus opens up. And inside that delightful breath, you see the really delightful nimittas. So what do you do when you see, like a nimitta, a light in the mind, or a vision, or whatever? What do you do? Mindful and kind, that's all. Don't do anything. It's really crazy. People, they do all the right things, and then they get to the nimitta, and they blow it. They think they've got to do something else now. I've got to hold the nimitta, I've got to develop it, I've got to make sure it doesn't go, I've got to really take notes so I can tell my friends about what my nimitta was, because they haven't got one yet. I have, but you haven't. And they just really mess around. So instead, just mindfulness and kindness all the way. It's a nimitta, that's okay. Just like your breath, be kind to your little nimitta. Just you imagine it, it's just someone just checking you out, coming to see you for your first time. Yeah, nimitta, I'm here. Can you just accept me who I am and just be peaceful, be gentle with me and be kind to me and not try and change me or own me or treat me as a slave? And if you look at the nimitta with the right kindness and mindfulness, it stays with you and grows. As the as the lotus starts to open, really nice stuff now. Nimittas, wow, shh. Don't grab hold of them. Be mindful, be kind. And then you go inside the nimittas. They open up. And then, wow. You don't say wow. You get the jhanas. Like nothing I've ever seen before. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Ecstasy. But all in the mind. So this is powerful states. This is where the mind is totally free from the senses. You go right inside your lotus. And of course there's more little things inside those nimittas, inside those jhanas. But that will come on another occasion. Because it's 2 minutes, 3 minutes past nine now. And I've run out of time. And I know when you give talks, you never finish the talk because you allow people to wait with anticipation for the next episode of opening the lotus. Sadhu! 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 So tomorrow morning, continue on to what's inside the lotus. Okie dokie. So the interviews are still on, and also the afternoon interviews, 3 to 3:30. It's just at 4 o'clock. There will be no sutta class.